I'm very pleased to welcome back to you from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Welcome back, Martin.
It's fantastic to be here.
I suppose you can say to people, "What were you doing last Saturday?" There's a good number who will say, "Well, I was at the Great Dockers, went over the Hawthorn Hawks at Optus Oval in Perth." There'll be others who'll look at you shocked and say, "You mean you weren't watching the coronation?" And I have to say, I was in the latter category. Some, of course, don't respond well to my suggestion that there's not a lot of value in watching the coronation of an English king. They respond, some of them, but you'd be watching the coronation of the Australian king, and that really raises the hackles of a Republican. Martin, what were you doing last Saturday?
Oh, well, I was there on the south coast of New South Wales with family because I was travelling at the time, and I came back midweek. So I was completely out of the radar with all sort of media and everything at the time. So that's my excuse. But look, there's no doubt that the English do pomp and pageantry extremely well. They love it, and there's for the Brits, and this is a as ceremonies and traditions going back hundreds and hundreds, maybe well over 1,000 years. Really, if you go back to the Anglo-Saxon kings and their coronation. So there's a lot of history there for them. I guess there's going to be an inevitable debate in Australia about their relevance to Australia. Of course, at the moment, the King of Britain, Great Britain, is the King of Australia. So essentially, that has quite a bit of relevance, and that's why Anthony Albanese was over there. And the Governor General and others. And of course, the Governor General is the representative of King Charles III. So we have a definitive connection there. And I think the Prime Minister probably got it right when he said, well, if the Australian people all those years ago, 24 years ago, made their decision, then that's the system that we have. I've got no doubt that in the future, there'll be more discussions about a republic. And a lot of Republicans have long felt that the change of monarch would lead to those discussions. But for the moment, people were just enjoying the symbols of yesteryear being wheeled out again. But there were some interesting aspects too. I didn't, like I said, I didn't see it itself, but I did see some highlights, and they have tried to modernize the ceremony. So there's a mixture of a bit of old and new in there. But it was certainly, I think most people, there's a lot of people who are not even alive the last time there was a coronation. So it's quite an astonishing event for a lot of us.
Well, one thing that I probably would have liked to have seen, and particularly to have heard, Martin, was the rendition of Zadok the Priest, the coronation anthem that George Frederick Handel wrote for the coronation of George II, 4 years short of 300 years ago. Those who love their classical music, not just coronation music, said it was an absolutely brilliant performance, so people should go and see if they can get the highlights of that, or otherwise go on YouTube and listen to it. But Martin, while all that's been happening, and have been getting over it, and getting over in Fremantle, high voltage performance around the streets of Fremantle, great music last Sunday afternoon. We've had the federal budget, we've had the state budget, we've got Don Farrell, the Trade Minister in Canberra, heading off to China. We've got things happening in Israel and Gaza, and we've got Trump convicted, but not that you'd know if you were watching him. And we've got things happening again in Bankshire Hill here. Let's take them from the top. The federal budget, was it a non-event? Was it all expected in the end?
I don't think it was a non-event. I mean, it's a really significant juncture. It was the first Labor budget in a long time. You have to go back to Wayne Swan and then the very end of the Gillard Rudd years to get the last Labor budget. It did feel a bit different. So there were some concessions. Concessions not the right word. Some additional support for low-income people, including people on JobStart, JobSeeker, I should say, people rent assistance for some people, some other means of support. I think single mums, they lowered the threshold from 14 years to 8 years for receiving benefits there. So there were some significant assistance pieces. And I think the other thing that I think took a lot of people by surprise is that they produced a surplus. It seems it will be a temporary surplus because of the way that the revenue is forecasted over the forward estimates. But for now, they were able to trumpet that fact. So it was quite an interesting budget from those perspectives.
So Jim Chalmers, how do you read him? He sort of comes across as a very regular guy, a Paul Keating without the snide side.
Well, that's an interesting assessment. I think he and Keating get along well, which itself is interesting because Keating's a bit out of favour. He's taken a few shots, particularly at Penny Wong over China. But I think that there's a little bit of a swagger there. I don't think it's as obvious as Paul Keating's swagger, but he does project confidence, which is not a bad thing. I mean, Peter Costello was projecting confidence as well. You want to know that your finances are in the strong hands. So he's a fairly consummate performer, I think. He's always comes across as on top of his brief. I think he deliberately lowered expectations around what he was able to deliver by repeatedly saying you can't do everything and then probably delivered a bit more than what some people expected. Clearly, he didn't deliver enough for other people who would have liked to see more in terms of assistance for the vulnerable. But I think that probably just underscores the sort of where you'd expect to send a left budget like that.
Well, I watched the Leader of the Opposition, Peter Dutton's budget reply on television late yesterday. He seemed to come across as the friendly sort of politician you might meet at a barbecue and think he's a regular guy too. And I suppose he is. Didn't have a lot to say, I didn't think. What was your take on the reply?
Yeah, it was quite interesting because I think he has tried to remodel his image a little bit to appear a bit softer and a bit more approachable. And I think that's very wise because he's got a big hurdle to overcome people's perceptions of him. So I think that was smart. It doesn't seem very supportive of a lot of the assistance for that we just talked about there. So I'm not sure about the fate of that in terms of the coalition. He threw one nugget in, which is interesting. He wants to ban gambling ads. So I don't know if you picked up on that, Michael. I thought that was quite interesting. And there's little echoes there of Dom Perrottet's agenda. And the thing about Dom Perrottet's agenda is it appealed to a range of fairly standard conservatives, but he didn't hemorrhage the votes in the New South Wales election as badly as Morrison did in the federal election. So maybe that's some subtle repositioning there. We'll see if that actually is followed up by anything else.
Well, we segued pretty quickly from all of what was happening in Canberra on the budget to everything that was happening in Perth up on the hill with the state budget here at the Shipping News, where all the media releases from government come first. I had to abandon everything else I was doing and keep checking through tens and tens, must have been 50 or 100, all announcing what a wonderful thing Western Australia is doing, great economic management, and everybody's a winner. And I suppose on the electricity account front, that's absolutely true, Martin. What did you make of the state budget?
Yeah, so it was quite an interesting budget. It talked about the rude health of the WA finances. The economy here is very strong. To announce a budget surplus of over $4 billion at state level is huge, especially at most other jurisdictions are running deficits. It will, of course, feed into accusations from other states that we've got more money than we need. But bear in mind, there is a substantial debt that we're still paying off as well at state level. And there were quite a few handouts and quite a bit of assistance here and there, particularly the $400 electricity bill rebate. And utilities being pegged lower than inflation. They are still rising though, and you know the cost of living here is very, very real, especially for low income earners who'll find that really tricky. Housing was a big issue. There's a lot of money being poured into it, but the pipeline for the 700 odd additional houses That's going to take quite a few years because the construction industry here is in disarray. You can't build anything quickly. There's a shortage of the right skills, and sometimes there's a shortage of the right materials. So there's the housing shortage is not going to be solved anytime soon.
Well, I caught an interview on television, ABC television. James Carmody, the local ABC TV political reporter, firing some questions at the Premier and Treasurer Mark McGowan, at the end of which the Premier, they seem to have left the vision on for a moment or two, just put everything down, didn't continue to have any eye contact with the reporter, and turned his back and walked off. It was a rather telling moment. He was singularly unhappy. And I think it's because all James Carmody did was kept coming back to the question, which he wasn't happy with the answer he was getting. But if you didn't have China, wouldn't this budget of yours just be hopeless? It wouldn't be black, it would all be red. And tell me about China if you didn't have China. Is that an unfair line of questioning, do you think?
We have other buyers for our ore as well, but they are the biggest one. And no doubt, if you look carefully, you'll see that the royalties are making a massive impact here. And the second thing, we do have a bit better GST deal than we've had in prior to the recast of that. So there are some prevailing winds that have helped enormously with this budget. It can't be denied. There is some things that the government can take some credit for. Bear in mind that they did peg public sector wages. They froze them for a number of years. Operational costs for the West Australian budget were very substantial when they came into government. So there were some tough decisions made back then. They have to loosen those purse strings now, though, because of inflation and because of the cost of living. We're doing really well on the back of some fortunate economic circumstances. And if you look deeper at federal and state budgets, they are often predicated by now the budget or the surplus or the deficit is often very closely linked to the international economy and the broader economic circumstances. Governments have levers to pull, but if you go back to the Howard government's revenues were really substantial. They were still spending a fair bit. They're still at a high expenditure to gross domestic product. But because their revenue was strong, they were able to produce surpluses. So that argument, I think, probably always rang true.
And I think that was Mr. McGowan's response, which I had some sympathy for, more or less. Well, that's the way the world of trade works. There are big ones and little ones and different ones at different times. But talking of China, a politician with a reputation for being good at counting numbers, Don Farrell, a senator for South Australia, is the trade minister as well. He's off to China. I wonder if he's been able to count the numbers properly so far as those further negotiations are concerned, Martin. What are your expectations, Australia-China trade?
Thank you, Michael. That's a good point. That's an interesting point to raise. Don Farrell has worked fairly tirelessly behind the scenes to try and improve trade, and there are some green shoots coming through. It's of particular importance to the WA agricultural sector because we're especially export-orientated, and things like barley and others, crayfish even, up in Lancelin and Ledge Point, places like that. Very reliant on the Chinese market. So it's of particular interest to us. I would say that the tone and the diplomatic aspects of that relationship have changed substantially. But the actual loosening of the trade barriers or loosening of the regulation is still coming. And that's, I think, what Don Farrell's been charged to try and get action on behind the scenes. We'll see how that plans out. Probably we'll have to wait for over the next 3 to 6 months.
Well, we'll watch with enormous self-interest, Martin. But an area where you expect trouble, you get it. You can be filled with despair, as I feel again at the moment is this little Gaza Strip. The combatants, Israel, Hamas, other groups, rockets firing in all directions. Many Palestinians killed by the Israelis this year compared to the number of Israelis killed. What's going on at the moment, Martin? Is it just the regular flare-up? Is it something to worry about? Of course, it's something to worry about, but we need to worry about it a lot more. Is there any end in sight?
Look, it is very depressing. I think it is a bit rinse and repeat. What we get is out flare-ups of violence, a lot of finger pointing, a lot of blaming on both sides, and the people on the ground that are suffering enormously, and particularly in the Palestinian side, there's enormous suffering. And you wouldn't want to be on the border sites in Israel either and having rockets fired at you either. But I think people, well, the political and military leaders argue it's the people in those areas that are suffering the most. And I'm not very optimistic. I can't see any moves towards peace. I don't think there's been any substantive moves towards peace for a long, long time. And all we get is perhaps some ceasefire and a lull in the violence before it starts up again.
Well, I mentioned Trump at the top of the podcast. We now arrive with Trump, and you sort of say his name and you sort of smile outwardly or inwardly or both. And then you reflect upon the week of Trump we've just had. He's been found liable to pay about $5 million US to a woman who said he sexually assaulted her. The jury accepted that was the case. He just laughs it off at a CNN town hall style meeting the other day. But amongst other things, he's pressed on Ukraine. He leaves you with a distinct impression that if he were or was still the president, he'd ring up his mate Putin and probably giving everything he wanted. What do you make of Trump at the moment?
Well, I did see, I didn't listen to the whole town hall, but I looked at some of the highlights of the town hall, CNN town hall. And they are quite interesting to see and try and pick up the tone of what he's saying. He is doubling down, as you would expect, probably on a lot of things. Didn't really want to criticize the people that stormed the Capitol on January the 6th.
He
Still
pardoned some
claiming
of them.
he. Yeah, he didn't. He still argued that the 2020 election was stolen from him. There's a lot of those same arguments rehashed. So he's not changing. He's very defensive about some of these things. We, of course, had this ruling on the jury ruling that he sexually abused. Someone some time ago and defamed them and had to pay damages around that. Now, that would probably sink most political candidates, but it's not going to sink Donald Trump because it probably just feeds into his narrative that he's a victim of elites, whether it's judiciary or media or otherwise. So he'll sail on. The show will go on. There's the Ukraine comments were especially interesting. He has two lines he's arguing. He's arguing that somehow he'll actually bring Trump to Putin to the table and do a deal, and sort it all out. But he's also not especially worried about whether Ukraine wins or loses. That's the undertone that's there. So it's quite a markedly different foreign policy from the current administration. And foreign policy from the US is especially interesting to us because it does very much tie in with our foreign policy.
You've touched upon the isolationist approach of not just Trump, but perhaps the Republican Party more generally. Do you think those comments concerning Ukraine, which I read the same way as you, will be of influence in the US support for Ukraine at the moment?
I think that there's a lot of water to go under the bridge. And a lot of Republicans still have their own views about Ukraine. The populist right are critical of the war altogether. But there's quite a few Republicans, enough, I believe, that that are suspicious and cynical about Russia and supportive of NATO, very much so, so that they'll continue to support the war. But it is one to watch if Trump's campaign gathers steam, as it will over the next 6 to 12 months. So it's not often you see really significant cleavages in US foreign policy within the US, and that's what I'll be watching.
Well, on coming programs, we no doubt will discuss the position in Sudan and try to understand better what is happening there and where it's likely to go. There's so much, of course, always going on around the world, but we've got our own really unhappy outbreak of riots at Banksia Hill here in the West. It's been the subject of a lot of publicity on national media, and there was another outbreak when we thought it was settling down. Do you have any sense of what's happening, what's behind it, whether it's all capable of a resolution, why it hasn't been resolved?
Oh, look, it's one of those issues that just sort of festers on. It's very hard to, it dies down and then it comes back again, So that's just, it's one of the, but, the broader issue is people have their existing fault lines and I think they fall back on them, Michael, which probably explains, how we get to with this. None of it surprised me. I don't know. Did it surprise you?
No, it doesn't, because the unhappiness of juvenile inmates just simmers. No doubt there's a lot when it comes to the situation of a lot of these young men, how they feel. And I suppose they understand that the sort of publicity it's got, and if they are unhappy, it's a way of breaking out. But it still shows that the thing festers. And we have to do better, I expect. Mm. But it's always troubling when you see the sort of vision we had on our television screens over the last few days.
Yeah, I think it is trouble. And I think one thing we can say is whatever we're doing at the moment is not working. There's a need to go back to the drawing board. But I think that, it's a reminder that the more people we can keep out of jail in the first place, or out of detention in this case, the better. That's the first thing. But trying to understand the people involved is going to be crucial, and then understand what types of things we can put in place to prevent it. Obviously, to prevent them going to detention in the first place, but obviously, what you're really hoping to do with juveniles is rehabilitate and rejuvenate. So I wouldn't pretend I have the answers, but I think they're very disturbing images.
Martin, we've had a reasonably depressing set of topics to talk about. Money always worries people, unless, of course, it's in Western Australia. There's a lot to go around. All of these conflicts here, there and everywhere. And our sensibilities, of course, being impacted by Donald Trump. But you might say, thank goodness for Zadok the priest, beautiful music, the coronation. It brings a bit of light and life into the lives of those who otherwise are obviously tragics. They should get a Republican badge and try and spirit themselves up. But we'll come back to another set of discussions next week. I think it'll be time to return to The Voice, talk about where the campaigns are at. Yesterday, the no campaigns got together. I'm not sure what that signifies. And we'll perhaps analyse for our listeners just where the campaign is in the middle of May, not that far away from the referendum. But until then, it's been lovely speaking with you, as always.
It's my pleasure, and a lot of interesting topics this week.